Well, we are in Galatians again, chapter 1, verse 11 and following. We had a crowd last week. Yeah. Must have really been bad. So it doesn't invite you to get out, does it? It's not very inviting. Well, it begins, you know, as we saw last week, this letter is confrontational in the sense of Paul writing to Galatians and alarmed about their departure from the gospel. And in this section, he begins his defense of the gospel. And it's not so much a defense of the gospel at this point, in the broad sense of, we might say, arguing about the gospel. But it becomes a defense of his authority with the gospel and his the validity of the gospel he has preached because of where he attained the gospel message from. On the one hand, which he will do, to say this is the gospel, here's the content, I'm going to prove why this content is accurate, would be one thing. It would be another, and which is more what Paul's doing here, is saying, this is why I have the authority to preach this gospel. That's why the gospel I preach, it has authority. He says, "For I would have you know, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man." So he it ended the last part, if you remember, verse 10. He said, "For am I now seeking the favor of men or of God? Or am I striving to please men? If I were still trying to please men, I would not be a bondservant of Christ." So he puts himself in that position of, am I trying to please men or God? If I were trying to please men, then I wouldn't be God's servant. And this is when he follows that up by saying, the gospel I preach is not according to man. It's not in line with the teachings that a man generated. So when he says it's not according to man, he's not saying that his gospel isn't in accordance with the gospel that maybe other apostles teach, but it's not. It doesn't originate from. It doesn't flow from. It's not dependent upon. So it'd almost be, with Paul, and as he'll show us, that the church, almost, I guess we could say all the other of the apostles of the church, their gospel came from a certain source. A lot of it was experiential. They grew up with Christ. They, or his ministry didn't grow up with them, but I mean in their discipleship grew up with them. They're exposed to that. They have Christ as the source and that his human walk on earth. Obviously, the revelation from the Spirit. But there's a very much a part that's generated to the teachings of Christ while he was walking on the earth, that tradition. Paul comes along, and Christ is not on the scene. He's already been crucified. Now, Paul was alive at the time, but we don't know. But they don't seem to have had any direct contact. Surely Paul was aware of him, but that doesn't Peter be direct contact. And clearly Paul wasn't a student of Christ. But yet now, as he'll go and show, he has the same gospel, but it came directly from the risen Christ. So Peter would say, my gospel came from Christ, but it was while Christ was walking on the earth. Paul is going to say, my gospel came from Christ, but it came directly. And so there's an authority that he's giving here. So it's not according to man in the sense that it's dependent upon men. For I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. Well, that makes Paul, in this regard, unique from the other apostles. Now, the other apostles have something that Paul didn't have. Paul never walked with Christ. They had personal experience with Christ upon the earth. In that sense, they were literally followers of Christ, and Paul never was, in that sense, a physical follower of Christ. But he's saying, I received it through a revelation. Verse 13 says, for you have heard of my former manner of life in Judaism, how I used to persecute the church of God beyond measure and tried to destroy it. All you have to do is look back in Acts and you see this. You know, Luke introduces characters in Acts, kind of interesting. There's only a few of them, but he'll make mention of them and pick them up later. And Paul, at the stoning of Stephen, it says that they laid their coats at the feet of Paul. That's the only mention to him. Then it picks him up later. Well, when he's picked up later, he's on his mission, on the Damascus Road, on his mission to zealously persecute the church. I mean, he took it upon himself, went and, volunteered for a job that didn't exist. I guess, he proposed a job, volunteered to be the person that was appointed to be the chief prosecutors of Christians. And so that's what Paul was known for, how I used to persecute the church beyond measure. So, I mean, there wasn't anybody else to, there's no way to really gauge it because he was the one doing it. His mission was to destroy the church. And I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries, among my countrymen, being more extremely zealous for my ancestral traditions. That whole rank of Judaism, of being a rabbi, it was a field of employment, endeavor, just like anything that we would know, that you study for it. It clearly had some political aspects to it. And Paul, as we know from other things, was from a wealthy family, which would make sense. He was educated, and he had, kind of a top standing, as he, informs in Philippians and indicates here. He was on his way to the top of that realm. So he was very high in that. So everybody, when you look at that, people in the church would be very concerned about Paul because of that background. And we see that in Acts, that people are concerned, to be around him. But when God, who had set me apart, even from my mother's womb, and called me through his grace, was pleased to reveal his son in me so that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately consult with flesh and blood. Nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went away to Arabia and returned once more to Damascus. There are two really important things here. Paul has set the background that he was as anti-Jesus as the Messiah as anybody could be. It's not possible to be more so than Paul was. You might be equal, but you couldn't be more than Paul was. And with that mindset, his heart intent on destroying anything associated with Christ, he says, God, who had set me apart from my mother's womb and called me through his grace, when he was pleased to reveal his son in me, there's clearly some aspects of an election, if you make it, push election to a certain point where there is no decision, it gets difficult to try to reconcile all those things. How do we reconcile the call to belief and people believing in God's call? And it is difficult, something that I'm never going to master. I'm convinced of that one. But when we go to the other hand and put the focus solely upon human will and human decisions, there's no way that lines with Scripture, to do that. So somewhere in there, there's definitely some sense of a mystery that we do respond, we do believe. But, if we do that at the if we say all that at the expense of saying God doesn't call and God doesn't initiate, boy, you know, what do we do with passages like this? And that seems to be the whole point, is it's not that somebody came along and gave a nice sounding gospel message and Peter or Paul said, I think Jesus may be the Messiah. I mean, you have a person that's just headstrong, set on going this way, and all of a sudden one day he went that way. And, those kinds of things, it's, I don't know how you chalk it up to, I just made a decision. You may have made a decision, but something initiated it for you to even be thinking about it. And that's where Paul's at. But not only did God set him apart for this calling to salvation, which is not what he's focused on here, but connected with that salvation, Paul wasn't just saved. Paul wasn't just called to be a Christian. Paul was called to be an apostle. And all of that was revealed at the same time, which is very unique. Some of us may, have some sense that after we became a Christian, that God intended for, moved us to do something or have a certain interest. But I doubt very many of us have that tightly together. And then especially to be so opposed to God and then to say, well, not only am I going to align with him, I'm going to be, his spokesman. But that's what he says he did there. He revealed his son to me for the purpose or the result that I might preach him among the Gentiles. But then he gives this other information. When that happened, I didn't immediately consult with people. And so you think about that God calls you up and says, I want you to do whatever. And we would say almost immediately, well, I need information, training, something here. And we would go seek out a person, read a book, whatever. And what happened to Paul was totally different there too, is he went away to an isolated place, away from the Christian influence, and generated in him this understanding of the Christian faith. My understanding, if any of you are, depending on what experience you ever had with Bob Thieme, Thieme had a deal that was referred to as super grace, and it took 3 years to get there. And it's off this concept here, is that Paul went away for 3 years, and so that came this idea that you could, it's almost like a super Christian. I don't really know, how you get to all that, but nevertheless, it's off this concept that Paul was away for 3 years, and he came back in this, which I don't know, even if that was true in that regard, I don't know if that means it applies to everybody else, because you're also talking about direct revelation. And you're also talking about somebody that had an incredible amount of information already stored up in his being. He just was anti-Jesus as Messiah. But he was very knowledgeable to begin with. That's a big difference. Some people progress very quickly in their Christian life because they already had a realm of information to begin with. You think of Martin Luther. He was a seminary professor. Now, he wasn't what, in his terminology, even wasn't what, was a Christian believer by faith, but he was extremely knowledgeable. And even in his description of what occurred in his life at that moment of faith is that he was teaching Romans and teaching Psalms, and all of a sudden his mind was racing back and forth, putting passages together. So he had a foundation for that. So Paul had more. He wasn't just some blank slate at that point either. But he says he didn't go up to Jerusalem, which would be expected. He didn't go up to the apostles, but he went away to Arabia and returned again to Damascus. Then 3 years later, I went to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Cephas, that is Peter, and stayed with him 15 days. So after 3 years from his Damascus experience, 3 years as a Christian, Paul finally goes to Jerusalem. He is called to be an apostle to the Gentiles, but there is a 3-year training, but it's not, you know, what we would typically call missionary training. He says in verse 19, "But I did not see any other of the apostles except James, the Lord's brother. Now, in what I am writing to you, I assure you before God that I am not lying." So, even after 3 years, he only had contact with Peter and James. He's saying, my gospel, the gospel I've been preaching, didn't come to me from these people. It didn't come because I hung around a bunch of Christians. Didn't come because I hung around the apostles and learned all their stories. The gospel that I preached came directly from the revelation of God. He said in verse 21, "Then I went into the regions of Syria and Cilicia. I was still unknown by sight to the churches of Judea which were in Christ." So the Jewish churches still didn't know Paul by sight because he hadn't been there, but he was preaching elsewhere. "But only they kept hearing, 'He who once persecuted us is now preaching the faith which he once tried to destroy.' And they were glorifying God because of me." See, that's that. There are going to be two responses if you hear Paul is preaching the gospel. One is, wow, God is incredibly powerful, how wonderful it is. The other is, I don't believe it. And isn't that what we do when we hear of a jailhouse conversion? You know, death. You know, somebody on death row that is a conversion. We're either, depend on how we hear it, depend on, you know, who had the opportunity to talk to the person, we either go, that's just manipulation, I don't believe it, or, you know, we're astounded that somebody in that situation came to know the Lord. Or when you hear it of somebody that's, you know, their life is just so contrary, you know, everything that we have understood them to stand for is contrary to that. And so some celebrity, when we hear it and, you know, it goes around as rumors, you're either like, you know, at least you're going, wow, if that's true, that is fabulous, you know. But you also may be, well, I don't know if I believe it. Well, that was some of the ones with Paul. If you read in Acts, they were hesitant because, hey, isn't this the guy that was persecuting the church? But then we see here others were like, when they realized it, there was that glorifying God. He's changed. So Paul is given in here a testimony that others recognized he was a changed person. But the main thing that Paul is doing here is the statement that he received the gospel directly from God. And why this is important is that when Paul is going to confront the Galatians about the gospel, and he's going to say, you've so quickly deserted the gospel I preached you, he's saying the gospel I've preached has come directly to me from God. You know, I didn't get my gospel from there. It's not something, you know, I'm not dependent upon this person. Therefore, I can take this stand because it came from God. He is not at this point or never really saying that his gospel differs from the apostles in Jerusalem. Now, he obviously has an issue with Peter that we'll see. But it's not really over the gospel. It's over what Peter has done that reflects on the gospel, but not the content of the gospel. And so that's where Paul is coming at in this point. It's a defense of his authority and his authority in relationship to the gospel, which becomes, you know, foundational for Paul in making this appeal, that he can be confrontational to Peter because he's not dependent upon Peter for his understanding of the gospel. Now, where that would come into place is if I were to take a professor, you know, Dr. Ryrie, and I, you know, needed to confront Dr. Ryrie because he's gone, you know, he's off on some point of doctrine, then, you know, what's my basis for it? You know, the best I could do is say, Dr. Ryrie, this is not what you taught me. And which at that point, you know, let's say, then it would be, well, you didn't fully understand or you didn't understand correctly. I understand it better now, whatever. But if my thing with him was, you know, I know you're a learned person and so forth and so on, and you've got this tradition, but I have this direct revelation, and now I think you've missed this point. When I'm explaining to you that it's a different stance, and that's what Paul's doing here, is he's got a different position to approach this. The reader should be listening. You've got to deal with what he's saying, or else totally discount him. You know, if you want to say he's not an apostle or he doesn't have any authority, but you have to totally blow him off. And remember, he's the one that brought the gospel to them. And so they have a relationship. But that's where he begins in this, his defense. He started first by saying, I'm shocked you so quickly left the gospel. Now he's saying, hey, the gospel I preached to you came directly to me from the Lord. And then he'll move on with another aspect of that authority that the church has also recognized him as an authority. So anyway, at this point, any thoughts or insights or questions? Or yeah, isn't that that is pretty amazing.
You get this all the way from over here, and we've all gotten it, other places, from being face-to-face with Christ or ministry, and yet the message.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be a lot easier to look at it and say, whatever conspiracy theory you have, if it all was dependent upon one or two apostles. And their remembrance. And yeah, when you start disagreeing with the Bible, you have to disagree, unless you're just going to kind of be liberal and not believe it, period. But you either have to really just push it all out. If you're going to be honest, you can't just kind of pick and choose, because it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't hold up.
Talking about this three-year period.
I'm trying to think if there's something in Acts. Does anybody know?
Acts 9:25 says he went.
Yeah. So he says, then 3 years later, I went up to Jerusalem. And so even this period, it's a little, it's one of those things given a timetable. Because if you notice even his wording, he said, nor did I go to Jerusalem to those apostles, but I went to Arabia and returned once more to Damascus. Then 3 years later, then 3 years later from what point? From the call?
Right here, or 3 years in Damascus.
Yeah, or was it the call? Did I go to Arabia and then I went to return to Damascus? And it's 3 years at that time. So was I 5 years in Arabia and then, Damascus? Yeah, there's... That is not, obviously you're going to come, scholars are going to come to an opinion, but I don't know that there's any, exactness, like an exact chronology, because he's not trying to give us that exact chronology. His point is, it was a period of time before I went to Jerusalem. Even when I started my ministry and I've been preaching the gospel, I hadn't been to Jerusalem, and I think that's his point. And so even here to say he went somewhere and studied for 3 years isn't even what this passage is saying. He went somewhere, received the gospel, exact time I don't know, but he's already been preaching the gospel before he goes to Jerusalem.
Well, and the thing that they're doing in Galatians is kind of going back to their Jewish roots.
Right.
And so there may be some significance there that he's gone. I didn't go to Jerusalem for 3 years. If he is not, the Jew of Jews did not go to Jerusalem, then that's a significant thing. Because as a Jew, he would need to be in Jerusalem.
Well, that's an interesting one. I hadn't thought about that. It's a good point.
It kind of addresses the dropping of Jewishness.
Yeah, not even just the, not only the apostles there, but the whole idea of Jews, yeah.
struggle when people tell me God told them something, you know, the way to start a debate. You know, because you can't debate that at that point. It's revelation from God that such and such is true. You know, if you dispute that or disagree with that, you're disagreeing with God.
Yeah, so you either got to say, I don't believe you, you know, period. You know, I don't believe, you know, you're lying. This didn't come from God. It's, you know, from some other source that, you know, I guess, I don't know what at best at worst is here. I guess at best you're lying. At worst it's a demonic source, you know. But you can't just say, like you were saying, you can't just say, well, I don't know if I agree with that. You know, it's Yeah, if you get to that. And that's an easy way to get authority sometimes, I think, today, is to say, oh, it's from God. And that's a... Well, I think that's... And I think today, you know, when we do that, and I don't think there's anything wrong, but I think, I don't think we have to, like... put things in exact wording, like there's this formula. If you don't set this way, you're doing something wrong. But there ought to be a way that we do it, that we say with a conviction. We're communicating a conviction, and that I believe God would have me do this. But it's, you know, it's me. It's not, you know, when we come to a point today and we say, you know, God told me you need to. That's a totally different. And that's what Paul is saying.
Yeah.
You know, And see, I think that's the... Sometimes we have problems with semantics, and so use the word God's... He speaks to us. Well, sometimes that creates a lot of problems for some in our camp to use that kind of wording. I just love this, and it's one of the few things I really clearly remember from a chapel as a student. But this one of the younger professors at the time, you know, it's his turn to speak in chapel, and he said, how did he put it? I think he said revealed. God revealed to me. Well, you know, that just wasn't language used at Dallas Seminary. And, you know, it was kind of like, I mean, it was, you know, kind of an attention getter. And then he paused and he said, or if you prefer, he impressed upon me. Now, if you can say God spoke to me as a synonym for he impressed upon me, or, you know, those things, then, you know, that we should be perfectly fine with it. Now, I know some people won't be fine with it because, you know, I had an argument with a guy once that, we were doing Experiencing God, and Blackaby uses, you know, God speaks to me. But if you read Blackaby in the front, he's very clear. It'd be this idea of impressing. And this guy just went on and on and on, and finally said, you know, because he just wouldn't, it's like he can't use that word. And if you use that word, it's just wrong. Well, there's nothing wrong with the word. It depends what you mean by it. And so in some context, you'd be a lot better off not saying it because it'll be understood wrongly. But in that regard, we should be of that we pray and that God speaks to us, God impresses upon us, God reveals to us. But it's not that objective revelation of handwriting on the wall that, there's a conviction. You know, I believe this is from God, and I act on it accordingly. And that's appropriate. But this is not what Paul is saying, I don't believe. You know, he's not saying, I have a conviction. He's saying, this is... Just like he's not saying, I had a conviction that this light shined on me. I'm not really sure if a light shined on me. I'm not really sure if I was blind. I'm not really sure if I heard a voice. He's saying, I was on this road, and, you know, Christ spoke to me, and I was blind, and, yeah, you know. So that's a different setting. Well, are there prayer requests?